This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, August 6, 2004. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. The UN announces that the Sudanese cabinet approves a plan for Western Darfur. FSRN talks to Green presidential hopeful David Cobb. And we commemorate the 59th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But first, these headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Iraqi fighters and U.S. forces in Iraq are still locked in armed conflict as the casualty count continues to rise. Dave Enders reports from Baghdad.
Across the country, fighting took place in Samarra, north of Baghdad, in Najaf, Nusayriya, and Basra in the south, and rebels are in at least partial control of those cities. U.S. military officials reported as many 300 militiamen had been killed since Thursday, a number a Sadr spokesman said was wrong. Fighters in Sadr City, the slum district of north Baghdad from which Sadr draws most of his support, clashed with U.S. troops on Thursday but said on Friday that the ceasefire would be reinstated if U.S. troops stopped coming into the neighborhood and stopped arresting the movement's leaders. Friday prayer services in Sadr City were abbreviated as fighters prepared for a U.S. incursion. The prayers were also held in a different location because the street in which they are usually held is flooded with sewage. In Baghdad, this is David Enders reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
Today, the Israeli military finally released their hold on the border crossing from Gaza to Egypt after 3 weeks. Leila El-Haddad reports from Gaza.
Israel has reopened the Rafah border crossing between the Gaza Strip and Egypt under pressure from the United States, the European Union, and neighboring countries. Thousands of Palestinians were stranded in the crossing for over 19 days in unspeakable sanitary conditions. Three pregnant women miscarried during their wait, and one gave birth to a baby boy. The move comes one day after Israeli troops redeployed from the village of Beit Hanun in the northern Gaza Strip, leaving behind a trail of destruction. Roads were ripped apart, factories, wells, and houses destroyed, and more than 42,000 olive, citrus, and date trees uprooted, say local officials. The month-long siege is said to have caused some $40 million in damage. For Free Speech Radio News in Gaza, I'm Leila El-Haddad.
The Nigerian government is cracking down hard on what they consider to be extreme Islamic groups. Several people have been killed in northern Nigeria following a police raid. Sam Olakoya reports from Lagos.
Authorities are yet to give the exact number of those who died during the police raid on the Islamic group. But residents of the northern city of Birnin-Kebbi, where the raid occurred, said several people were killed. They attribute this to the stiff resistance put up by members of the sect, which is known as Yan Gwawamaya. The sect, whose members number several thousands, say they do not recognize the authority of the government. In January this year, security agents moved against another Islamic group known as Taliban after its members started attacking police stations and government buildings. Nigeria has one of the largest Muslim population in the world. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos, Nigeria.
26,000 U.S. retirees can claim part of $75 million in pension money. Sarah Turner with the Workers' Independent News Service explains.
The Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation announced today that $75 million of retirement funds have gone unclaimed from at least 26,000 U.S. workers. The PBGC is a government agency responsible for taking over pension obligations from bankrupt corporations, mainly in the airline, steel, and transportation industries. The states with the highest number of claims are New York, California, Texas, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. Americans who believe they may be eligible for pension money can check for their names at the PBGC website. With the Workers' Independent News Service for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Sarah Turner.
Unhealthy levels of bacteria in the water closed the nation's beaches a record number of days last year, according to a recent environmental report. Erica McDonald has more.
There were more than 18,000 days of beach closings and advisories across the nation last year, more than double the number from 2002. Pollution from sewage spills and urban runoff is the source of disease-causing bacteria and other pathogens. The National Resources Defense Council, or NRDC, report found 88% of beach closings were attributed to the presence of human and animal waste. NRDC's Elliot Nagin says Clean Water Act rollbacks and EPA budget cuts by the Bush administration are exacerbating the problem. Nagin also blamed deteriorating municipal infrastructure, including aging pipes and sewer lines. NRDC recommends increasing a revolving state fund for communities to clean up the water. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Erica McDonald.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman with Free Speech Radio News.
The United Nations announced today that the Sudanese cabinet has approved a UN-sponsored plan to begin disarming Arab militants in western Darfur in the next 30 days. The news comes as the African Union prepares to deploy a token force to the region to protect truce observers, and amid reports that the militias are continuing to massacre Darfurian civilians. Susan Wood has more from the UN.
The deal was reached this week in the capital Khartoum between Jan Pronk, the senior UN envoy to Sudan, and Foreign Minister Mustafa Osman Ismail. UN spokesperson Denise Cook told reporters Thursday it was not yet known what further commitments Sudan had made beyond those agreed with the UN Secretary General last month.
We can't be specific about what's in this agreement because it's only just been signed and it still has to be cleared by the Sudanese cabinet, so it's not considered an official or public document as of yet. The information we have is that it contains detailed steps to be taken in the next 30 days. On how to begin to disarm the Janjaweed and other outlaw groups, on improving security in Darfur, and on addressing the humanitarian crisis. But we'll have to wait for this agreement to be cleared.
Another spokesperson said today that the cabinet's approval clears the way for the agreement to be finalized and published on Monday. Mahgoub El-Jitani, president of the Sudanese Human Rights Association in exile, welcomes the news.
Any steps that are serious and consistent that the government of Sudan would be taking to disarm the militias and to restore security and peace to the region should really be encouraged.
El-Jitani warns, however, that measures announced recently by senior Sudanese officials undermine confidence in the government's commitment to disarming the Janjaweed. For instance, he says, the interior minister has begun co-opting militia fighters into the police force.
And then there is all these troops that are roaming the region, and many of them are identified by the victims of civil war in Darfur as the ones who were haunting them, killing them, and doing lots of things. There is this air bombing that was reported just a few days ago.
The UN Security Council on July 30th passed a resolution giving Sudan 30 days to curb the militias and give aid workers unfettered access or face possible economic sanctions. The UN has described the situation in Darfur as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, with 50,000 dead, 1.2 million driven from their homes, and 350,000 people facing starvation. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
This month marks 4 years of Plan Colombia, the $3 billion U.S.-sponsored anti-drug program using the Monsanto-made herbicide called glyphosate to spray the Colombian countryside. It's been 4 years in which Colombian campesinos, officials, and women's groups have marched en masse to protest the aerial fumigations and the displacement, hunger, health ailments, and lack of work they've caused. However, both the U.S. and Colombian governments continue to insist that aerial fumigation with unreleased levels of herbicide is the only answer to the drug war. Reporting from Colombia's Magdalena Medio in Bogotá, Nicole Carson examines what 4 years of fumigations has meant for Colombians.
On July 30th, more than 600 campesinos traveled by motorboat along the Cimitarra River through the humid, lush jungle lands of Colombia's Magdalena Medio to attend a meeting on fumigations. This region is a bastion of Colombia's conflict, with a strong presence of guerrilla groups, paramilitaries, the federal army, and, in between the crossfire, the civilian population, many of whom are coca growers, cultivating the base ingredient for the cocaine that is smuggled into the U.S. One woman from the Sur de Bolívar questions the media's coverage of fumigations that does not reveal what she, as a coca grower, suffers in terms of health, damage to food crops, and basic survival.
On the television news, they show the planes passing over the beautiful crops. This we can see, but what we can't see on the news is when they pass over and kill the yuca and corn crops. They don't show how they leave all us campesinos without anything to eat. I think they should show this so the government sees the harm that they're causing in the region. All of us who cultivate coca, we're not doing it because it's a lucrative black market crop, even though the government sees it as illicit. But here we are, generating work.
Colombia's central north region of the Magdalena Medio, like southern, northern, and coastal Colombia, has been sprayed with the Monsanto-produced herbicide called glyphosate on three separate occasions. According to locals, the fumigations have caused miscarriages and severe skin ailments. The U.S.-sponsored spraying has killed food crops, poisoned freshwater sources, and left many without work. As the campesinos converged, duster crop planes flew over communities an hour away, dousing another indiscriminate dose of glyphosate over their land. The president of the Cimitarra River Valley Campesino Association describes some of the damages the fumigations have caused during the past 4 years.
Unfortunately, our land is being poisoned with glyphosate. This is not only a policy of eradicating coca, but also of eradicating human life. As campesinos, it affects us as it does the rest of the world. All the air we breathe is our air, and the water we drink from are the poisoned water sources.
Thousands of subsistence farmers in the countryside have been forced to abandon their land after damages caused by fumigations, and many end up struggling to survive below the poverty line in Colombia's towns and cities. The International Organization of Migration conducted a study in the southern department of Putumayo, concluding that during the year 2003, some 7,000 people were forced to abandon their lands because of fumigations in this one department alone. Ecuadorians who live near the Colombian border have also suffered harm to their health and lands because of the aerial spraying that has extended into Ecuador, even though there's no coca there. In Ecuador, an estimated 6,000 families have been displaced because of fumigations. Marcela Ceballos is a Colombian analyst who has followed the effects of forced displacement caused by fumigations during the last 4 years.
Displacement associated with the fumigations has two characteristics. First, it's completely invisible to the state registry system because the Colombian government doesn't recognize those displaced from fumigations. These people cannot receive humanitarian aid, and this means that the humanitarian crisis is increasing and not attending to the needs of victims.
Despite the more than 6,000 complaints registered by Colombia's Human Rights Ombudsman and the more than 8,000 requests submitted to the U.S. Embassy in Bogota of peasant farmers seeking indemnization for damages to food crops, animals, and human lives, both the Colombian and U.S. government do not recognize that aerial spraying damages life. On paper, Plan Colombia is set up to repay the victims who suffer losses caused by fumigation. However, of the more than 8,000 complaints, only 6 cases have been indemnized during the past 4 years. On August 3rd, U.S. drug czar John Walters spoke with a group of journalists at a hotel in Bogota.
And most of the investigation, we've followed up on these very aggressively of claims of individuals being harmed. We've generally found that the cause is really something other than the glyphosate. That's either, in some cases, it's been, you know, other diseases that are not uncommon to poor people working in jungle areas and children and others who are put into the workforce. But also some of the chemicals that are used in the cultivation, insecticides, fertilizers, which are not used in, at levels that are even prescribed by the commercial manufacturers of some of those products and can cause, we know, various harms.
The American Medical Association recently released a statement saying that fumigations have caused widespread illnesses, destroying pastures, food crops, poisoning livestock, and displacing thousands of small farmers. The American Medical Association requests the immediate cessation of aerial herbicide spraying in Colombia and its neighboring countries until the health effects on the local populations are properly studied. Although the U.S. and Colombian governments have never conducted a proper scientific study on effects of the herbicide and continue to insist on using the aerial spraying to eradicate coca, many coca growers continue cultivating and have simply moved to new regions within Colombia to plant. According to U.S. analysts, the price and strain of cocaine in the U.S., 90% of which comes from Colombia, has not changed during the past 4 years of Plan Colombia, despite the more than $3 billion in police and military aid that the U.S. has given Colombia to fumigate their people and lands. From Bogota, I'm Nicole Carson for Free Speech Radio News.
You are listening to Free Speech Radio News. Archives of our program are available on the web at fsrn.org. Over 8,000 journalists of color converged in downtown Washington, D.C. for the third gathering of Unity, an alliance between the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, Native American Journalists Association, National Association of Black Journalists, and the Asian American Journalists Association. Selena Musuta has more.
There's never been any type of policy with the Bush administration to help people of color. And I'd like to understand what his case is going to be to the journalists.
Thousands of journalists were greeted by 25-year-old Kyle, an organizer for the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Kyle stood outside with tens of others in front of the Washington Convention Center to protest President Bush's appearance at the Unity Conference. Bush was one of many high-profile speakers to address the convention goers. Roland Martin, editorial consultant for the Chicago Defender, the oldest black newspaper in the United States, questioned Bush during a Friday morning plenary.
In terms of when you came out against the Michigan affirmative action policy...
No, I said I was against quotas.
So you support affirmative action, but not quotas.
I support colleges affirmatively taking action to get more minorities in their school.
That's a long headline, Mr. President.
I support diversity. I don't support quotas. I think quotas are wrong.
Democratic presidential hopeful John Kerry also spoke during the week, as well as Secretary of State Colin Powell.
I don't think that journalists right now are asking the tough questions.
That was Angela Burt Murray, editor of Teen People magazine. Murray was able to see some of Kerry, Bush, and Powell's speech. For Murray, these speakers sidestepped critical issues that affect her readership, teenagers.
They have friends, they have family members that are stationed over there, and they're very concerned about this war. They're concerned about how are they going to pay for college. They're concerned about the gay marriage issue.
Many news outlets use this gathering as a way to recruit more people of color to their newsrooms. Part of the convention center was turned into a sort of job fair. Three Cadillacs were showcased. The Coca-Cola logo was imprinted on bags and notebooks. Advertisements for products were equally as bold as signs for diversity. First-time Unity goer Reggie George, a staffer at the only Yakima Nation-based radio station in Washington State, appreciated aspects of the conference, but was bothered by others as well.
I live on the reservation, and there's three NBC, CBS, and ABC affiliate stations. They're like 20, 30 minutes away from where I live, but they're on the other side of the border. So when I see these people here, like the NBC's here, ABC's here, and CBS is here, it's a sales pitch. I don't think they're really out seeking diversity. That's what I think.
This year's conference theme was called A Powerful Alliance, A Force for Change. Addressing the needs of journalists of color while diversifying the newsroom has been the focus of Unity since 1994. Executive Director of Unity, Anna Lopez.
The reality is that we have to have more people of color in management to help make those, to help change those stories and to make, you know, our communities more relevant, and that they're not just reporting on communities of color when there's a crisis or it's in a negative way.
For Helen Zia, one of the featured authors at the convention, having more people of color in the newsroom is not the only answer to dealing with issues of diversity. corporate control of the media also affects diversity.
In a corporate environment, all that counts is money. If it makes money to depict blacks or Asians or Latinos or Native Americans or gays and lesbians in a certain way, then that's where the money goes. It also means that there will be fewer small publishers, ethnic media press, community press that can actually get out there and have their voices heard.
Unity will shift its focus away from programming such as scholarships and fellowships to more issue-based campaigns that would broaden the accessibility of media to communities of color. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Selena Masuta.
Meanwhile, Green Party presidential candidate David Cobb is now on the ballot in 29 states. The Green Party is aiming to put the Cobb-LaMarche ticket in a total of 35 states. Today, FSRN's Mitch Jezerich spoke with David Cobb about his candidacy.
Green Party presidential candidate David Cobb, welcome to Free Speech Radio News. First, we'd like to ask you, in which many consider to be a crucial election year, why is it important to run as a third-party candidate?
Well, it's important to acknowledge that historically, third parties have played a profound role in American history. The abolition of slavery, women getting the right to vote, the creation of the Social Security Administration. All of these were initially proposed by alternative parties, so-called third parties. But even more than that, the establishment parties, including the Democratic Party, actually fought against those issues when they were first proposed. It has always required social movements to actually make systemic change, and a political party that's willing to run candidates on those calls for social change and systemic change.
So do you plan to run vigorously in swing states in which some say a third progressive candidate could actually help George Bush win?
John Kerry is a corporatist and a militarist who voted for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He voted for the Patriot Act. He voted for NAFTA. He opposes universal health care. He opposes raising the minimum wage to a living wage. Having said that, here is another truth. As bad as I think John Kerry is, George W. Bush is qualitatively worse. But George Bush is not the problem. The real problem is the entire social, political, and economic system that is literally destroying our planet and creating a racist, classist, sexist world order with the plunder. But I understand that there are some people who are genuinely terrorized of the idea of four more years of Bush. If they're going to hold their nose and vote for Kerry, I'm not advising them to do it. But if they do that, I understand, and I'm saying, then work with us to change the voting system, register into the political party that obviously reflects your values.
It appeared that there was some controversy at the Green Party convention in the nomination of both you and your running mate, Pat LaMarche, who are both white. Some critics contend that the ticket lacks diversity.
I acknowledge that I'm a white person, but I'm also a white person who acknowledges and says white privilege exists, and even though I grew up poor, I benefit from white skin privilege. You know, we are centralizing race and gender and sexual orientation in our campaigns. Everywhere I go, I talk about racism and sexism and the oppression for queers, gays, lesbians, and transgendered people. I mean, it's just part of my stump speech.
But still, some feel that the Green Party, along with other progressive groups, isn't doing enough outreach into minority communities.
Well, you know, for me as a white person, I know that in order to be a good anti-racist ally, I have to organize white people and educate white people about issues of white skin privilege and racism and how it works. Now, there is a need to do continued outreach, but I don't want to be the kind of white person who goes into communities of color trying to convince them to join the Green Party. Instead, what I do is go to people of color that I know and encourage them individually to join the Green Party based on the personal trust and relationship that I've built with them over time.
Now, independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader ran as a Green 4 years ago. What separates you from, say, Ralph Nader?
You know, Ralph is running as an independent, which is his right to do. But at the end of his campaign, his effort is basically over in electoral politics. I'm representing the Green Party, which is a growing political party based on peace, social and racial justice, real democracy, and environmental protection. The Green Party is getting larger, stronger, and better organized with every election cycle. And at the end of this election, the Green Party is going to keep on going.
And that was Green Party presidential candidate David Cobb. You can learn more about his platform at www.votecobb.org. Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
We must not have a nuclear war. We must begin to solve international disputes by the application of man's power of reason.
That's the voice of Nobel laureate Linus Pauling, speaking in 1958 against the use of nuclear weapons. 59 years ago today, the United States dropped an atomic bomb on the Japanese city of Hiroshima, instantly killing more than 80,000 people. 3 days later, more than 75,000 people died after the U.S. dropped another bomb on the city of Nagasaki. While between 50 and 100,000 people gathered yesterday in Hiroshima to recognize the lives lost, survivors of the Nagasaki blast are in Washington, D.C. for a series of commemoration events. Despite nonproliferation treaties, there are at least 20,000 nuclear weapons on the planet, half of which are in the U.S. arsenal. The Bush administration is designing a national missile defense system in Alaska with peripheral sites in Australia and Argentina. The D.C. Radio Co-op brings a sound from a commemoration event at the Roosevelt Memorial last night.
1945年8月9日, 母は用事で出かけました。 5歳の私はその後を追いかけました。
On August 9, 1945, a little before 11 a.m., my mother and some women from our neighborhood left home to get our lunchtime rations. As I ran after my mother, I saw some airplanes approaching. It's unusual, they look like American airplanes because they seem so vigorous, one of the women said. I looked up at the contrail when I saw a sudden flash and heard a loud explosion.
Mr. Suiichi Kido, the Secretary General of the Gifu Prefectural A-Bomb Sufferers Organization.
The shelter was full of the sound of people groaning. A young man came and fell in front of the shelter. It was one of my brother's friends. His entire body was burned. He kept crying, "It hurts, it hurts," and he died soon after.
Phil Wheaton.
Those bombs were not only an anti-humanitarian disgrace, they signaled the beginning of America's blatant imperialism right after the United States had rejected and defeated Japanese imperialism.
Mr. Suguo Kawano, and he is the board member of the Tokyo Federation of A-Bomb Sufferers Organizations, Hidankyo.
私の願いとしては、半世紀以上前の 被爆の惨劇を思うと,
here is my wish. Looking back at the misery caused by nuclear radiation more than half a century ago, I strongly feel that nuclear weapons should never ever be used again against human race. As use of biological and chemical weapons is prohibited by the international treaty, nuclear weapons should also be banned in international laws.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York, KPFA in Berkeley, KPFK in LA, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Simba Russo. Headlines editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram. DC editor is Mitch Jezerich. Our technical production team is Jade Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, Mick Millen, and Eric Klein. Special thanks to Transbay for web services.